So I'm going to try something a little bit different today. I thought I'd just sort of take you through some reflections on things I've learned so far in doing this show. And some things that I've been thinking a lot about as we head into the last sort of 60 days or so to the election. So I'm going to take you through like three or four ideas I've just been kind of mulling around and would love to know what you think about any of them. Just a quick reminder that you can always reach me through Farah@crosstabspodcast.com. You can subscribe to the Substack, which I will be restarting this week. We've been off for a couple of weeks at crosstabspod.substack.com. A quick note about that and about this show. Some other fellows, hilariously also from Oregon, which is where I'm from originally, they decided to start a show called Crosstabs as well. They started the show after this one launched, but they were able to claim crosstabspodcast.substack.com before I got to it. So that was a little confusing when I went to do this because when I first started this show, there was nothing else called Crosstabs, which, let's be honest, a huge oversight by people who work in polling and politics. Nevertheless, I want to dive in on some of these things that I've been thinking about. So the first thing I want to talk about is the idea of crosstab truthers versus just looking at crosstabs. One of the things that started to happen this year is a lot of amateur politics junkies, would-be pundits on Twitter, whatever, have started to dive in to crosstabs looking for insight into what's happening with the election. It's become pretty fashionable among that same set of people, frankly, other pundits, other commentators, other former staffers for campaigns. Here I'm thinking about people like Dan Pfeiffer of MessageBox and Pod Save America to criticize what they're referring to as crosstab truthers. So obviously, since my show is called Crosstabs, I suppose I should say something about that. But it's pretty straightforward. And it's this. If you're looking for proof that you are right about whatever it is that you think you're right about from the crosstabs, then no offense, but you're doing it wrong. What's interesting about crosstabs is being able to see how different groups of people's opinions and preferences change throughout the life cycle of an election and how that demographic group's preferences and opinions have changed since previous elections. It's also interesting to try to take a look at how identities intersect. You might look at an overall approval rating for a candidate and then look at the breakdown by party affiliation and find that a number is extremely high because one side's partisans have much stronger favorable opinions about their guy than the other side does about their guy. Those things are interesting data points. But if you're looking for proof that the top line number is wrong, then you're kind of expending unnecessary effort. There's another thing, though, that I think you should really watch out for when you are looking at crosstabs. And I'm assuming here that you are coming to them with curiosity as opposed to a particular axe to grind or because you're trying to self-soothe about polling numbers that you don't like. And that's this. If you're getting really upset or exercised about a crosstab that has a base size of fewer than like 100 to 150 people in it than a national poll, then just stop looking. These numbers are so small that the margin of error is going to be enormous. And as a result, at best, that information is directional. Here in particular is where you might want to look at, well, what did African Americans in this poll say last time versus this time? Did it move in any particular direction? If it moved a ton, then either some massive exogenous event occurred or something's wrong. You happened to get in one poll a sample of 100 Black voters who felt a particular kind of way, and in the next poll got a group of Black voters that feel a completely different kind of way. Black people are not a monolith, so you cannot say, based on 100 people, that they are representative of all of the nation's Black people. The same is true of women. The same is true of white non-college or college. The same is true of any ethnic group. If you are looking at base sizes within that crosstab of fewer than about 150 people, I would just take it with so much salt that you begin to pucker. So spending too much time in the crosstabs is not an inherent waste of your time if you are doing it out of curiosity and if you're looking at trends over time. If you're doing it because you have an axe to grind or to self-soothe or to prove that the top line number isn't what it is, there are definitely better things you could be doing with your time. The second thing I wanted to talk about is models at a high level. What you are seeing when you go on to the 538 page or you subscribe to Nate Silver's newsletter is not the model. You are seeing the forecast. The forecast is the output of the model. The model is not totally visible to you. Some of these folks publish the underlying model structure that they use to build their forecasts. Some of them don't. Some of them just sort of describe to you what factors they take into consideration, but don't publish their weights. It all kind of depends on the forecaster. Most models, however, are grounded in more or less three big categories of data. One is what frequently gets called the economic fundamentals. This is economic data like jobs, prices, housing starts, GDP growth, inflation, that kind of stuff. These data are not something candidates typically are able to have any kind of influence over in any meaningful way. This data is collected typically by government agencies, published regularly, and revised regularly. We talked about this in the episode about the nation's data at risk report that Connie Citrow worked on. You know, just this last week, we got a major revision of the last year's worth of jobs reports. It's a survey that is a snapshot in time. It is conducted every month. I have started to say about the jobs report that it's kind of like Saturday Night Live. It doesn't go out because it's ready. It goes out because it's Jobs Friday. We see these kinds of data collected by government agencies, published regularly, revised regularly. We also see other kinds of data that are reflections of other things. So inflation has started to cool off. It's now around 3%. That seems to be indicating that the Fed is going to reduce interest rates by a quarter of a point or something like that. Neither candidate in the race right now has an influence over inflation. Neither candidate gets to set interest rates. So these are also data that get incorporated into the model that neither candidate or nor their campaigns can truly influence. And sometimes this information is really out of date by the time you're given it. And so here's a fun fact for you. The NBER, which is the National Bureau of Economic Research, they are the ones who declare whether or not we are in or have had a recession. And they often don't declare a recession until well after one has begun. They don't really predict recessions. Several months, sometimes a year later, they will tell you that there was a recession. And we may already be coming out of that recession by the time they report on it. This is data that exists. It is high quality data. It is trustworthy data, but it is constantly being revised. It is collected by government organizations. It is not something that the candidates or their campaigns or voters, for that matter, can do much to influence. So they are kind of nice, hard seeming numbers that forecasters can use in building their underlying models. And we'll come back to why they use economic data at all in a minute. The other set of data that's collected are political fundamentals. Is an incumbent running for president or not? If an incumbent is running for president, then the approval ratings of that incumbent president matter quite a bit, particularly as you get closer and closer to the date of the election. If the incumbent president is not seeking re-election, then the question is about the incumbent party. How popular is the president of the incumbent party? It's a little less important to the overall number typically than if he were in fact seeking re-election. But nevertheless, incumbency is one of these political fundamentals. Increasingly over time, other types of political data that are incorporated into models account for party polarization. The other things that get factored in here are also used in developing the kind of weights for polling averages. And those are things like historical turnout and party preferences by different kind of demographics, and turnout and party preferences state by state, because part of what you're also trying to do in a forecast is predict the electoral college outcomes, not just the national vote. The third bucket of data is polling. And depending on the model, the polling may not be the most important, heaviest weighted set of the data that's considered in developing a model. Those are the three components of a model: economic data, political fundamentals, and polling. So the first really kind of famous model for predicting electoral outcomes was developed in kind of the early 1970s. A lot of people were playing with different kinds of models, but an economist is the person who gave us our first solid model that a lot of these models are fundamentally built around. Fun fact, that economist was actually the economist Emily Oster's father. She is a sometimes controversial figure on parenting Instagram. He identified two tandem predictors of the presidential races. One was GDP growth, and the other was the approval rating or favorability rating of the candidates. Now, I want to put a slightly finer point on those two data points, because it's not really like just that. In fact, the GDP growth question is not over the lifetime of the party in power's record or the past party's record. They're not comparing the GDP growth of the last 4 years with this president versus the GDP growth over the four-year term of the prior president, for example. They're really just looking at the last 6 to 12 months. So the year of the election, how is the GDP doing? Is it growing? Is it growing slower? Is it declining? Is it stagnant? And then the other part of this is the approval rating of the incumbent party's president. It's not so important what the approval rating of the challenger candidate is. Those are two things from the very first kind of popularized, widely used model developed by Emily Oster's father in the early 1970s. So to give you a sense of what that would look like, if the GDP is growing and the party in power is popular, then the party in power should be expected to stay in power. But if the GDP is declining or is growing more slowly and the party in power is unpopular, then the party in power should be expected to lose power. So it's a pretty straightforward kind of model. And like I said, most models in use today are really just, if we're all being very honest, slightly more complicated versions of that. But the thing you really need to know about models is that they are fundamentally retrospective. They look back at presidential elections since about 1948, which is the first election year where we really had what we would now consider to be reliable polling and reliable economic data. They identify factors that seem to correlate with incumbent party wins and losses. And they apply weights to those factors. They revise their weights and values and correlated data points until, as they run the model, run this sort of experimental, simulated election over and over and over again, they revise those weights, those values, those data points until they get a combination of factors that match the electoral outcomes of past elections. That's it. That's how it works. They are always fitting the past to the outcomes in the past and then trying to use that to predict what will happen next time. If those factors work, if they in fact have predictive value over many elections, then they get more weight, right? But if they only seem to correlate with one election here or there, then they're not as important to the model. If they correlate with several elections or three of the past four, then they get more attention. But models get updated just about every election. And they get updated because things change. Political polarization is one of those things that has changed the way forecasters model perceptions of the economy, for example, because in the last 30 years or so, party preference has had more influence on our perceptions of the economy than actual economic data does. One of the things they've started to find is that particularly for Republicans, they tend to believe the economy is worse if a Democrat is in power at a much greater rate and intensity than Democrats when a Republican is in power. My question for you is, how much do you think elections are like markets? Because one of the things that initial economist said is that basically what voters are doing when they think about the last year's worth of GDP and how much they like the incumbent party is they are trying to assess the expected future value of voting for the incumbent again. Do they think the economy is continue to decline or grow? Do they think that they will continue to like this president? Do they think that this party and the performance of the GDP are correlated in any way? This is economic man trying to maximize future outcomes. So how much do you think elections are like markets? And so one of the things I wanted to do was a little Econ 101 and just take you through what a market is. What sorts of features do markets typically have? So one of the things they all have is an arena, a place to buy and sell. Doesn't have to be a physical location, doesn't have to be a single location. So we could call polling places and mail-in ballots the arena. Markets have buyers and sellers. There are people who are selling things, there are people who are buying things. If you don't have either one of those things, you do not have a market. So I suppose in this scenario, the voters are the buyers and the candidates and the parties are the sellers. Now, those buyers and those sellers have to have something to buy and sell, right? There has to be some kind of commodity, some kind of thing where we are exchanging value for services, value for goods. In the crude oil market, the commodity is crude oil. But in something like electronics, computers, smartphones, there's a bunch of commodities to buy and sell. Everything from silicon to other metals that are used in the production of parts to the chip makers themselves to sensors to cameras, so on and so forth. I guess the argument for elections being like a market here is that a candidate as a package for a set of issues that they champion and character traits, physical demographic characteristics they possess, personal biography, experience, that kind of thing, that candidate is the commodity. It is the product that's being bought and sold. There's also competition in a market. So more than one firm sells commodities or products or services in this market. We do have two or more parties on most of the ballots when we hold an election. Each are selling a different product or candidate. Arguably, we have competition. There's also exchange of value. There's pricing. You want this commodity. It costs this much money. You have to agree to that price, and then you pay it, and then you receive the commodity, right? So I guess voting is both free and not. Like, technically, we got rid of poll taxes, so you don't actually have to pay to vote. But it does cost time. It does cost effort. You have to pay for things like the cost of transportation, the cost of childcare, time off from work. You have to pay the state to get your driver's license. You have to pay the state for a copy of your birth certificate. Another simpler way of thinking about this is just, I give you my vote. You represent me in office. You represent my interests. That's the exchange of value here. I give you kind of a promise for a promise. I'm voting for you. You're going to do right by me. And then finally, there is a freedom to transact. I don't have to buy or sell anything. I don't even have to show up at the market today. You can sit out an election altogether. You can choose between these candidates. You can write in someone else you would prefer. All of this is entirely up to you. So yes, there's a certain kind of market freedom choice that exists here. But there are also some ways in which an election is nothing at all like a free market, right? There isn't a single day every 2 to 4 years in which we all decide to buy sneakers. So if you want a pair of Nikes, assuming that the kind you want and the size you wear are in stock, you can buy that anywhere, anytime. Voting, on the other hand, can only be done once every 2 to 4 years. There's only so many competitors on the ballot. Any competitor can't enter the market. The state regulates the requirements for appearing on a ballot. The parties get to decide who will get the resources and endorsements to make it out of the primary. You know, in some years, there has been a real sense that there's not a lot of responsiveness to market demand in the sense that the parties have selected candidates that the voters don't want to vote for. We saw that in the first half of this year, where something like a third of voters really just did not want to vote for either of these two major party candidates. And so, you know, not a very efficient market, I guess, a regulated market, a market that's kind of oligopolistic, I guess. So, yeah, a market, but not a great market. The candidates may or may not actually do or be able to do the things they say they will. And so when you think about that exchange of value of my vote for your representation, the value you expect them to create for you in exchange for your vote may or may not ever be realized. In this case, it's sort of like, even if you got the product you thought you wanted, it doesn't actually do what it said on the tin. So that's one way where, again, inefficient market, maybe a slightly fraudulent market, or a market where people's expectations and the brand's promises don't line up. That's not really how most markets tend to work. And so this brings up another problem with thinking of it as a market, which is that just because you buy a candidate with your vote doesn't mean you get what you purchased. So as you know, the way that our elections work is that a majority of people in states making up a majority of the Electoral College have to vote the same way for those people to get what they bought. Everybody who voted the other way, they're out. Their effort, their time, their money, they're stuck with what everybody else wanted to buy, or with what enough more people in enough places wanted to buy. If I order a pair of Nikes from a department store online, I go on Nordstrom's and I order a pair of Nikes, I don't get sent a pair of Adidas because that's what most of the other customers ordered that day. I got the thing that I wanted. So the reason I'm kind of taking you through this Econ 101 and these sorts of analogies is that I just wonder, are elections enough like markets for economic theory to really apply to them? I think it's a question worth asking yourself when you're looking at forecasts. Like, how much does the real world experience of being a voting eligible member of the electorate mimic markets and being a buyer or a seller? how much like buying and selling do you think campaigning and voting really are? And I think if you just sort of pause and think about that for a minute, it might give you a different sort of context or idea about how much weight you want to place on forecasts and these prediction models. Like I said, a lot of these markets are built around the idea of voters as economic actors maximizing their future expected value. How much will a firm or a commodity be worth tomorrow? But political forecasts aren't really about maximizing future expected value. I'm going to steal here from Mike Podorzer. The way he talks about political forecasts is they predict the past. And I think if you know that about forecasts, it might temper the way you respond to them when you see them. So I just want to drive that home. Forecasts are about what happened before, not about what's about to happen. You know how when you like get a prospectus for your 401k, it says something like past performance is not a predictor of future performance? The forecasters kind of want you to think that's not true. They want you to think that past performance is a predictor of future performance. And it's not true of markets. It's probably not true of elections, at least not at the margins where it really counts. I want to quote Mike from one of his pieces on Weekend Reading. He says, the statement, for example, that Trump has a 66% likelihood of winning does not mean the same thing as if I roll two dice, I have a 66% chance of rolling a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. It means that based on a set of data points selected by the model maker, for example, inflation rates and horse race polling, and a set of statistical relationships between those selected data points and election results in the past, the model maker is actually saying that if we had the same combination of the selected data points in the past, Trump would have won 2/3 of those times. Mike also writes, the idea that there is a knowable probability of winning the Electoral College if Harris wins Pennsylvania is Nate Silver's invention. What he is actually saying is that inside the model he has created, it's knowable. But that's only because every such mathematical simulacrum has a mathematical result. These things are useful fictions. Most statistical models are. Some are more accurate than others. Some are more reliable than others. But the bottom line is he's going to get a mathematical result because what he's done is designed an equation. And once you start plugging in values against your variables, you are going to get a result. That doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen. I think the longer I've worked on this show, the more I've become poll positive. Like, I think polls are really useful. In my universe of market research, we use this analogy all the time. You don't want to use data the way a drunk uses a lamppost for support instead of illumination. You want to use it for illumination. You want to use it to find your keys. And so this idea about is polling reliable or whatever, if you're using it to make predictions about what's going to happen, no, they're not particularly useful. It's not what they're for. They are snapshots in time. The snapshots in time are really interesting. And here's something where I go back to what Aaron Zitner said about using polling to see how the electorate has changed over time. That's a good use of polling. If you're using it, though, to say, here's what I think is going to happen in November, I don't know, you probably have other things you could do with your time. So I'm much more positive about polls now than I am about forecasting or about the predictive power of polling. And over time, I've just become less and less interested in the forecasts. I'm not even all that sure why we have them now. It's like 2012, 2016 is when Nate Silver kind of got famous and his model kind of got famous. And that seems to be when we all started paying attention to political forecasts instead of just like horse race polling and things people said and gaffes and appearances and, you know, crowd size or whatever else that we were using before as indicators. I do think that there is something about mathematical models used for forecasting that are represented numerically that make people think that they are relying on them. Relying on them to do what? Are you basing how you're going to vote based on the forecasts? Are you basing whether you're going to vote on the forecasts? Are you basing whether you're going to give money to a candidate or volunteer, knock on doors, send postcards, make phone calls? Are those things determined by what some guys at ABC News say is going to happen in 60 days? I'm not sure that's the right way to think about your role as a voting eligible citizen. I've been thinking about, are there circumstances where they might be helpful? Are there situations where they have more relative utility. And so I came up with a couple situations. Betting markets. Look, that's where Nate Silver basically comes from. He's a poker and baseball stats guy. He's into sports betting. He's not a pollster. He's not a political strategist. He's never worked on a campaign. When he looks at his predictions, he's thinking about what would happen if you put $100 down on either side. So he's talked about this in the context of the 2016 forecast, which gave Hillary Clinton a 74% chance of winning the Electoral College and winning the presidency. He looks at that projection and says, hey, if you'd put down $100 on Trump, you would have won big. You would have won your money back plus $74. If you put the same money down on Clinton, she'd have won. You'd only have won $26. If you're a risk-taking poker player, you are going to place the bet on Trump because the upside payoff is so much higher. That, to him, is a perfectly valid forecast. But I'm willing to bet that you, dear listener, when you look at the forecast, you're not thinking about how much money you're going to put down over at Predict It. You're thinking about the fate of the country and whether or not your political preferences are going to be realized by who wins the election. It's a very different exercise. So nevertheless, there's some utility there. If you want to win some money on the betting markets, then forecasts might be useful. The only other thing I'd add about that is last Thursday night at the DNC, the betting markets had a 96% chance that Beyonce was going to appear before the end of the night. You should have taken the opposite bet. You should have taken the bet that she wasn't going to appear because you would have doubled your money. Looking at prediction markets and thinking that's how things are going to go, good luck. The second context in which forecasts are useful, though, I think is for strategy. So if you are working on a campaign, working in a PAC, but in particular working on a candidate's campaign or working as an organizer for one of the major parties, then I think forecasts can be useful. If you think about the forecast, not from the perspective of margin of error, but once again, stealing from Mike Podorza, the margin of effort, then when you look at that forecast, you are doing so in a way that helps you understand the fundamentals at play, which of those fundamentals you can influence and which ones you can't. And so you look at the fundamentals you can influence. These are the political fundamentals, things like building awareness, improving favorability, persuading undecided voters that the stakes are high and that those stakes matter to them and that they should consider your candidate as the best one to handle those stakes. That's one part of it. What are the fundamentals you can influence and how do you go about influencing them and where should you put your effort? But the other part of it is there are all of these fundamentals you cannot influence and are going to change over the life cycle of the campaign. Like I said at the very beginning, like it looked like jobs numbers were doing great every quarter. Now they've been revised down like 800,000 jobs. So the jobs market has been cool for some time. Meanwhile, inflation has come down and it looks like interest rates are going to go down. Those things are important. You can't change them as a campaign, but what you can do is sense and respond to them. So what do you want to do when you find out that there's revisions to the jobs report? What's your message now? When interest rates come down, what's your message now? Who do you want to talk to and what do you want to talk to them about? But in my opinion, forecasts are mostly worthless to the average voter as voters. So here's my suggestion. I've been thinking about this. I think we should put the polling averages in the news and politics section of newspapers, and we should move the forecast to the sports section. If you want to bet on elections, go ahead. The forecast is great to have. But if you want to persuade your neighbors, volunteer for a campaign, phone bank, send postcards, knock on doors, the forecast is not relevant to you. I guess if you're a media organization that does your own polling and forecasting, then maybe forecasts are a great premium subscriber product for campaigns and super PACs. Sell that to them and leave us out of it. The last thing I want to talk about is something that's been happening a lot in the kind of pundit class and commentary. And there have been interesting surveys done by folks like Blueprint and others looking at messaging priorities. And here's something where I feel like I do have a fair amount of expertise. I've been working in marketing and advertising for 24 years, I have some opinions about this. Most brand communication of any kind really starts with an insight. And that insight is typically built on how people see themselves, how they see the category, and then how they want to feel about themselves and their place in that category. The insight that powers the Nike brand is the idea that if you have a body, you're an athlete. So you have to think to yourself, all right, we've got this insight into how people see themselves with respect to the category. So how are we going to translate that into how we do business, how we go to market, what kind of products we make, what kind of marketing we produce? In the case of Nike, the basic strategy is that we want to activate in all kinds of ways. Mundane, profound, competitive, amateur, whatever. The athlete inside all of our bodies. We want to activate your sense that you have the capacity to be an athlete, to do athletic things. And that is expressed with the slogan, Just Do It. I bring this up because there are two main threads in talking, in particular about the Democratic ticket. You will notice that they just don't do similar critiques for the GOP ticket. I think that's because Trump has basically broken political communication. Meanwhile, the Democrats are still more or less doing normal stuff. And so the press is going to hold them to normal critiques. All right. So here are the two main threads that pundits and political analysts and journalists have been using in talking about the Democratic ticket's messaging. The first one is this kind of open-ended question about whether or not Harris and Walz have provided enough detail about themselves and their positions on issues and the policies they would pursue so that voters feel like they know enough about them. Do I have enough information about these people to be able to give them my vote? That's the fundamental question that these journalists and pundits and political analysts are posing. There is a way in which that's just not up to them. That's up to the voters. Only the voters can decide that they have enough information to make a decision. And so the question then becomes for the voters, how much detail do you feel like you need? What would more detail give you? People don't really need a lot of detail about Nike products to appreciate them. They need to know what they're for and who they're for. They need to be able to see themselves wearing them. They need to be able to get them in their size. They need to be able to look at the price point and go, yeah, that seems reasonable to me. And they need to like the way they feel when they imagine themselves wearing them. And then they need to feel good while actually wearing them. They need to feel confident that other people will not judge them harshly for their choice. They need to know that once they've got the shoe, they will have made a good choice. I like the shoes. I feel good in the shoes. I wear the shoes. These are the things that they need to know. But they don't usually need to know, like, the precise manufacturing technique, or how the shoe was designed, or how they arrived at the price point, or what kind of shoe they're going to make next. I think the question also is simply, does the average non-politics junkie need to know that much detail? How much does that person really need to know about how Harris will address immigration? Do they need to know exactly how she's going to do it, what the specific policy is, what the budget for it's going to be, how many people are going to get hired, what the throughput of immigrants are going to be, how she's going to deal with asylum seekers versus people who have family members here versus people who don't, people from one country or region versus another? Like, how much detail does the average voter really need? Do they need to know simply that she wants to do something about the border? Do they need to just feel confident she can accomplish something at the border, that she shares their principles and values? What if one of our average voters just doesn't care that much about the border at all? Like, every voter is going to be different about how much they care about any of those things. And then based on how much they care about it, they're going to vary based on whether they're interested in the details of the policy proposal or the vibes, the principles and values that will govern the decision making and the approach to solving the issue. I think sometimes pundits and political analysts and journalists think that the answer to a confidence and commitment amongst voters challenge for a candidate is, let's have a policy. And I am skeptical about how detailed a policy really needs to get. The other problem is, which policy is going to matter the most? How much airtime, money, just energy and attention can I give to all the possible constellation of issues that matter most to any given voter? What if this average voter doesn't care about the border at all? They care more about reproductive health care or education or crime or wages or prices or housing costs. All of those things might be really important too. And I'll come back to that in a moment because it's relevant to the second point. The other real problem with this criticism, it's just like it's impossible to measure. Like, I can imagine asking a question like, how well do you feel like you know Harris's policy positions? And the scale is something like not at all knowledgeable to very knowledgeable. I'm not sure what good that question would do you, though. I am aware I don't know every detail of her plan to build more housing, but I am aware she wants to do that. I can imagine a voter like me saying they're very knowledgeable about it because they know about it at all and none of their friends do. I can imagine another voter with the exact same amount of knowledge thinking, well, I know she's for more housing, but I don't know specifics, so I guess I'm not that knowledgeable. These two voters would have exactly the same level of knowledge, but assess their knowledge very differently. You could try to take a voter through a battery of specific policies and ask them to attribute these policies to one candidate or another, a kind of like pop quiz, knowledge test. But we already know that a lot of voters tend to think their preferred candidate already agrees with them about most things. The problem that I really have with it is it's this movable goalpost, like perpetually movable. When will enough be enough? And if the pundits and the journalists are the ones who are trying to assess whether or not people know enough about Kamala Harris, what will satisfy them that enough voters now know enough about Harris in order to vote for her? I think sometimes we forget that there is a feedback loop between media and voter. If you've never heard of a brand before and I start advertising it, I'm able to tell you something about it, build some basic awareness of it, make it so that if you encounter it in the wild, you recognize it. And then that has this kind of feedback loop effect that affects your perception of that brand. Like, I told you it was a good brand. Then you saw it on someone walking down the street. Then you saw it on someone you knew. You saw it on someone who does a sport you take really seriously. And now you're like, oh, that's a good brand. So it is a question to me how much this criticism of, will she ever have told us enough details for us to feel like we really know her, is also something that is being put out there to undecided voters as not just an observation by journalists, but actually a message about the candidate. And that message could be something like, somehow Harris is withholding details about her plans for some nefarious reason, or she doesn't really have a plan at all, or she says she's in favor of one thing, but maybe she's secretly in favor of something else. Like, I don't know the degree to which these kinds of messages and feedback loops exist, and I don't know the degree to which we should be concerned about them. It certainly is true that in surveys and focus groups prior to the conventions, many people had told pollsters that they didn't really know enough to have an opinion about Harris. Many had basically never heard of Walz. So that is a data point worth watching. But basically, as of next week, when everyone's back from Labor Day weekend, you've either heard of Harris or you haven't. And if you haven't, I am hard-pressed to believe you're planning on voting in November, because the whole point of the conventions is to introduce to the public the nominee. And at this point, if she doesn't have near universal name recognition, that would constitute, in my mind, a pretty massive failure of communication on the part of the campaign, a campaign that to date has raised like $500 million since Harris took the ticket over. So I suspect that number is going to get smaller. But it is a data point worth watching. People did used to say that they didn't know enough about her. What did she do? Where was she? But there is a way that if we don't kind of move on from these survey responses, they can start to metastasize in the minds of journalists and become the hook. So do you feel like you know enough now? How about now? How about now? Was she specific enough? Did she say enough? Did she talk to enough reporters? Did she sit for enough interviews? All of that sort of becomes its own problem. And I don't know who's supposed to be satisfied there. And it can kind of take on a life of its own sometimes. You know, the press can keep alive a criticism for a long time that may or may not matter to voters. The second critique is any given message enough to win over undecided voters? Frequently, of late, you'll have noticed headlines about, is the weird messaging enough to win the election? Going back to brands for a brief moment, if Nike thinks you have a body, you're an athlete, and that to get you to buy their stuff, they need to like get you to see that athlete inside of you, they're going to motivate you to do that by saying, just do it. But also, that's not all they say. Nike doesn't just say, just do it. They show up in advertising, in their product lineup, in the events that they sponsor, in lots of different ways. They show up in the context. So are we talking about running? Are we talking to marathoners or about someone who's doing their first couch to 5K? Are we talking about Olympians or a 7-year-old on his first soccer team? Are we talking about people who swim to beat their best time or to beat their own fears or just because they like the way water feels? All of those things are conditions that Nike wants to be chosen for. They want to activate that part of you that wants to move your body for any reason at all, but especially because as an athlete, movement is who you are. So they can sell lots of different kinds of shoes and apparel and accessories across a lot of different sports and activities that way. You know, in 2023, they did $50 billion in sales worldwide. Adidas is their closest competitor. They're half the size. They do this by being in lots of places with lots of messages and lots of hooks that connect back to the same core idea. And so this is kind of why, in my view, worrying about any given single message being enough on its own to win the day is yet another waste of energy, and in this case, ink or pixels. Campaigns have to deliver lots of messages to lots of audiences about lots of issues. That's how they assemble a coalition to vote for them, to get them across the finish line in the Electoral College. That's the job of a campaign, is cobbling together all these different messages and pushing them forward in order to appeal to an audience. One of the things that drives me crazy about the retrospective on 2016 is that people love to say that Hillary Clinton had too many taglines, except she didn't. She had one tagline. It was stronger together. All of the other things, I'm with her, the woman card, these things were songs she played at events, hashtags they used on Twitter, bumper stickers they made. They're not the slogan. The core idea of that campaign was stronger together. There is a way in which everyone gets over their skis in marketing criticism here, because it's just not how campaigns work. We have lots of headlines, we have lots of hashtags, but the brand fundamentally stands for something singular. And if you are really interested in whether or not a campaign is doing coherent messaging that is trying to appeal to the most number of people, the question is actually about that core proposition. Change You Can Believe In was a core proposition that appealed to a majority of voters to surpass the Electoral College. Stronger Together sadly did not do the job. It certainly couldn't overcome all the other headwinds that were there. Every brand, at the size that these brands are operating, has lots of headlines, lots of different creative, lots of ways of expressing the core idea. And right now, between here and Election Day, the core idea behind the Harris Walz campaign is about freedom and the future. And so if that's going to motivate you to vote, then that's your candidate. If instead you like what the other side is selling, then that's what's going to motivate you. If the stakes of Democrats winning is too great a threat for you, then you will vote for the GOP. If the stakes of having Trump back in the White House are too great for you in a way that threatens you, you will vote for Harris. That's the most likely set of scenarios here. Some of you will be inspired positively on either side. Most of you will just be trying to mitigate threat, because that's how we operate as humans. If you're somebody who's very responsive to the pundit class and you worry a lot about how messages are being tested and which ones are breaking through and how one message or another is turning up in the conjoint testing that Blueprint is doing, you know, I guess, you know, if you've got nothing else to fill your time. But I can think of several things that if you're actually trying to affect the outcome of the election would be a better use of your time. And those things involve getting involved in a campaign, knocking on doors, writing letters, making phone calls, talking to your friends. And that's the thing that makes the most difference that you can do, in addition, I guess, to giving money. But at this point, both these campaigns have an awful lot of money. They could probably use the effort more. Coming back to what Mike Podesser writes about, it's not about margin of error. It's about margin of effort. And I've just spent an hour talking to you about things that I think a lot of people spend a lot of time talking and reading and writing about and commenting on social media. And I just don't think they matter all that much. Don't worry about the forecasts. If you're looking at crosstabs, do it because you're curious, not because you're trying to prove something. Marketing is complicated. There's lots of different ways to reach lots of different constituents. Let them get on with their jobs. If you've got a suggestion for a better message, start using it on your friends. And I'll see you next time. Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com. Tell your friends about the show. Subscribe on your favorite podcast service. Drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else. And we'll see you next time.